that I know how to handle these crises.
We are and always will be the United States of America.
Excuse me, Fox News.
A series of tubes.
I think we look pretty good.
I'll get Osama bin Laden, my friends. I'll get him. I know how to get him.
E pluribus unum. Out of many, one.
If some of those jobs are lost in this, so be it.
Make it Wisconsin!
Liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans, moderates of all opinions, welcome to Civil Discourse. My name is Eric Brandt. With me, as always, is former State Senator Peter Baer. How's it going, Peter?
Going great, Eric, and I'm really happy to have a very special guest with us today.
As am I. Joining us today to give us kind of an inside opinion of what's going on in the state capitol is Democrat State Representative of Middleton, Diane Hesselbein. How's it going, Diane?
It's going great. Thanks so much for having me here.
Thank you for being here. We're really excited. You got to go see the President of the United States last week. He came, and he was in Waukesha, actually. Can you kind of tell us just a little bit about it? How did everything go?
It went really well. It's so nice for a Democrat to hear our president. So often during the state address, we're not very inspired by what we hear. But it was so nice to actually see and hear President Obama about his message and that he's supportive of our agenda of raising the minimum wage. That was nice that he's in favor of that.
Very nice. Did you actually get to meet him at all?
I didn't, unfortunately.
No?
But I was very close. Closer to him than I was to you right now.
No, that's
about like one person away.
That's very nice.
You could feel the positive energy. Energy field.
I was. I could. It was amazing.
When he was here on the campaign trail back in 2012, when he was at Bascom Hall, I just fell into rope line tickets, and I was in about the third or fourth row. And when he came down to shake hands, I got a video of him shaking my hand, which was
wonderful.
That's one of my crowning moments. I was pretty interesting. He's number one, he's the president, but I got to shake hands with the first African-American president, which is pretty amazing.
I've never met him since he became president, but I did get to have about a 25-minute conversation with him at the convention in Boston in 2004 where he gave that keynote speech.
Yeah.
And we spent about 25 minutes talking mostly about international trade issues because I was working for a multinational company at the time and had some interest in that. And I remember walking up to my boss, who was the vice president of public affairs for the company that I worked for, saying, I think I just met the first black president of the United States. But I didn't think it would be that as soon. I thought maybe 8 or 12 years later. Mm-hmm. I wasn't thinking 4 years. But I'm glad it worked out that way.
Me too.
Representative, you have a proposal for the legislature right now called Lena's Law. And I saw recently that you had put on Facebook that you had a meeting with the governor coming up. Can you tell us a little bit about the law? How are things progressing? Where are we at with it?
Sure. Lena's Law is named after a woman from Middleton High School who was a student at University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh. And she died and drowned after going down the Wolf River. And the family came to me and Representative Melissa Sargent and said, is there anything we can do so that this doesn't happen to anybody else in the state of Wisconsin again? And we looked at the water flow, what could the – she had rented at an outfitter. She had – rafter. She got a raft. We were curious about the type of personal flotation device they had, what the water conditions were like. So we've been spending, I'd say, over a year on this law. And just had some suggestions in this bill that would require the outfitters to to offer a helmet. Currently, they do offer helmets, but we just want to be sure that that's on the books. That's important. The personal flotation devices are better than they were when Lena died.
So right now, they offer the helmets, but they're not required, correct?
Right, and this law wouldn't require it either.
Oh, it won't? Okay.
Because, well, it's very difficult in the state of Wisconsin. We can't require it for motorcyclists. So
we did at one time, by the way, you know, but way back in the late 70s or 1980, we actually passed a mandatory helmet law. And I remember with fellow colleagues, legislative colleagues, being invited to a state medical society event where they said, you legislators have saved more lives by passing this law than a room full of doctors. Unfortunately, though, some people came along later and repealed it.
And that is standing in the way of getting it for kayaking,
yes,
or rafting?
Yes, rafting. Yeah, that's
it's
one of the things.
It's really sad.
Yeah, people really don't like it. And then we'd say that if the water flow is between a certain strong, then they wouldn't be able to be rafting anymore. But it doesn't preclude you if you're a personal rafter to go down. It just says to the outfitters, let's have some specific measurements in place so that no other family has to have this tragedy again. And then also there's already something built on the land there that we say if the water flow is high, and we're specific on it, I can't remember it off the top of my head, have somebody there so that if people fall out, there's somebody there with a bullhorn or something that can direct them where to go. Because if those simple things had been in place, Lena would be here today.
And how is this being received so far in the legislature? Are you finding that Republicans and Democrats are sympathetic toward it, or are you to it, or are you kind of getting the over regulatory liberal kind of pushback?
They were very good in the beginning for this bill. In fact, Lena's family sent out releases saying, "Please contact your state representative to have them sign onto this bill." And I worked very closely with Republican Representative Jeff Merceau, who has the Wolf River in his backyard for his district. So his knowledge and insight were very helpful in crafting this. However, now I'm getting pushback because it is on some tribal land. And so when I met with the governor, which I had a meeting with him, I think it was last week, about this bill, he was actually very helpful. And he thought that the bill should get a hearing. Unfortunately, the chairman of that committee doesn't agree. And we're not getting a hearing, but I'm happy that the tribe is going to listen to the family. So we're hoping to have that meeting, I think, next week when the State of the Tribes, that the family will at least be heard. So I'm not sure if they're going to change their ordinances. The tribe's lobbyist, Joe Stroll, said that said that he would work on an ordinance, hopefully, to make things change.
If this committee chairman refuses to give it a hearing from just a... an administrative standpoint, do you as a legislator have the ability to take it out of that committee and submit it somewhere else where you might have more luck?
I don't. The unfortunate thing is the chair of the committee also signed on to the bill. I mean, this family was really, the family did a really great job of organizing around the state of Wisconsin. And they were like, how did you get so many people, signing on to this bill? And I'm like, when you have a 19-year-old who dies in a tragic accident, who's from Middleton, went to Oshkosh. She was a big sister in the program up there for Big Sister, Big Brothers. She's bilingual, and she was in the education, and she wanted to be an elementary school teacher. You get people all around the state that miss her presence, and they know the good that she would have done. People all across the state reached out to their senators and assembly people and asked them to sign on.
Who chairs the committee that has this bill?
Representative Al Ott.
From what community do you recall?
I'm not even sure.
Ott from... in the Sheboygan area back.
I think that's him. He's still,
It would be his son or something, probably, or his relative. Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Carlot?
I don't know.
Well, what makes me wonder is, the reason I ask the question is, when a committee chair signs on as a co-sponsor to a bill, and the governor even says the bill should get a hearing, the governor of his party says the bill should get a hearing, a governor who hasn't always been so sympathetic to the issues like this, something must have happened to get that committee chair to go from being a co-sponsor with the governor encouraging him to go forward to saying, I won't even have a hearing on the bill.
I'm not sure what happened. I think what it is, and it is a sensitive issue of the tribes having sovereignty and, us maybe not being able to mandate a bill or mandate a law for them. However, I was arguing with somebody, the water is a public trust. So that is federally that we can kind of go into those waters, pun intended. So I'm not sure what the hesitancy is there. And still, I think sometimes when you have a hearing, it doesn't mean you're going to exec on it and vote on it.
Right.
But to have a hearing, we could maybe flush out all those problems and maybe we would learn, we can't. But let's work with the tribes to have an ordinance instead and maybe change their minds and change their hearts. But they're hoping to have. We're going to be having that meeting with the tribes, and I'm hopeful that the tribes will take it under consideration. What happened to Lena?
Maybe it can be framed in such a way as for tribal members to recognize that members of the tribes could benefit from these safety measures too.
Well, absolutely. It's also a tourism thing. I mean, they want people rafting and being safe. They don't want that black eye on their outfitters.
Is there any avenue there? As you said, you can't you're having trouble getting the helmets mandated because of you can't do it on motorcycles. Is there any route that you can take where you're saying, okay, we're not going to make these mandatory if it is your personal device, if you're doing this on your own, but if you are renting it, then as a renter, as the person who is renting these out, then they have to be responsible for that?
No, there's nothing that you can do with that. But they are being provided, and they're being provided. You know, even last summer, those helmets are being provided. People don't take them, which is unfortunate. And it's really this one swath of the river, of Wolf River, that's really dangerous. And it's sort of like the last big drop-off that's fun and exciting. But when you don't know and you think you're going to be going on a raft and enjoying it, no big deal, that's the really scary part. And there do have to be some protective measures in place.
Do you have any feeling that, as you said, Governor Walker was supportive of the bill? Do you think that he will put any pressure on Chairman Ott to push this, to allow this?
I think what we're waiting for right now is hopefully to see how that meeting with the tribes go, and hopefully the family will be heard, and hopefully the tribes will take that in consideration and change their ordinances. But I do think that at this meeting the governor was possibly maybe going to send a staff person there.
Very good. It just, you know, from a civilian standpoint, it just seems like common sense to me.
Well,
but
it is. Yeah, I think it is.
There you go, being rational again.
Yeah, right.
There you go again.
That actually offers a really good segue into our next topic, though. You had mentioned that just by allowing the hearing doesn't mean that we're going to vote. It doesn't mean we're going to pass. It doesn't mean anything. I just saw a video yesterday of Robin Voss, and I think he was sparring with the Wisconsin State Journal editorial board, and they were pressing him to hold a hearing on redistricting reform, and he was throwing out every excuse in the book. And you and Melissa Sargent put out an article in the Cap Times back in December, I think, discussing that you are pushing for redistricting reform. Tim Cullen and Dale Schultz in the Senate are pushing for redistricting reform. And back in, was it maybe November, when you guys had the marathon session, I believe the Democrats tried to bring this up and the Republicans shot it down right away.
Yes.
Where are we? Because when I picked up a copy of the Isthmus today, it's the front page. They're talking about the gerrymandering. Mm-hmm. And what are we looking at?
We're looking at an uphill climb, unfortunately. That's what it is.
I like your diplomatic way of referring to that as an uphill climb. Like climbing Mount Everest.
That's what it feels like.
Yeah.
You know, without any good boots. But, you know, I think it's important that we do this in the state of Wisconsin. Redistricting has been so awful. And it's really neat. There's a YouTube video of Representative Voss talking with Scott Milfred at the Wisconsin State Journal. And I encourage your listeners to take a peek at it. It's very, very good. And they were saying, well, what about Dane County? Dane County is trying to do their own redistricting, and if they do it, would you have a hearing? And he's like, yeah, I'll consider that. So I'm currently on the Dane County Board until April, and I'm positive we're going to get something passed, and I will be asking Speaker Voss if he will keep his word.
Well, here's what I found interesting is one of Voss's main arguments there was that he conceded that if we went to a nonpartisan, according to some article that he read, and I don't know if it was written by a Republican, a Democrat, an independent, I don't know who wrote it, but apparently this person in the article had concluded that it wouldn't have made much of a difference in 2012 had the Republicans drawn these maps or had a nonpartisan committee drawn these maps. And he said that he thinks that it needs to stay with the legislature because you guys are the ones who are accountable to voters. But that's the complete opposite of what they've done here, is because, you know, it's, as we've talked about on this show, 190,000 people voted for Democrats, 190,000 more people voted for Democrats than Republicans, and yet you sit with, what, a 39-seat minority?
39.
And according to what they put here in the Isthmus, they said they had new voter boundaries drawn up behind closed doors by private law firms that would be paid by taxpayers. GOP legislators were made to sign oaths of secrecy before they could see their own districts. How is that accountability? How are they being held accountable to the voters when those are the circumstances? And do they not realize that people read this stuff?
Well, if I may, I'd like to pose a question to you to take this to the next level. Okay. Gerrymandering has been going on since the beginning of our country. I mean, it's an old term. Eric knows the history. I forget where it was. It the late 1700s or early 1800s?
I don't even remember.
It goes back that far. So this is not a new concept. It's just that, as Bill Clinton said about voter suppression, efforts by Republicans in 2012. He said he'd seen it all before, but he said, I've never seen it as brazen as this. That's what I say about the reapportionment that happened most recently in Wisconsin. It's happened all over through the years. Whichever party's in power is going to take advantage to some extent. But this is the most brazen thing I've ever seen. And they have literally locked in a substantial majority, at least in the assembly, for a decade. I've never seen it so extreme. What does it take? And I understand that you're an attorney. At what point do you get to the point where there is a legitimate federal challenge to the reapportionment because it is so has gone to such an extreme that there is no equity in it? There's no it essentially kills the one person, one vote principle upon which our country is essentially founded.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure the feds would take a look at it. I know I feel strongly about the state of Wisconsin and their gerrymandering as I do Illinois. And certainly in Illinois, the Democrats were in charge and did the same thing to Illinois. And it's not right. And they shouldn't be doing it. And they were using private emails with this Michael Best and Friedrich law firm saying, well, you know, I'd kind of like this area, but, you know, this district, this village is really good for me. And that's what was going back and forth. And we just need to put it to the hands of the nonpartisan Legislative Reference Bureau and let them take a crack at it.
Just to put some numbers on this, they've done this here, as you said, the Democrats did it in Illinois. The Republicans also did it in Ohio. In Ohio, the GOP won 52% of the votes for the congressional seats. So they legitimately won a little more than half, yet they control 11 of 18 seats in the House of Representatives. In Iowa, the Dems won 766,000 with 51%, and they control 2%, or I'm sorry, two of the four seats. They control half of the seats, and they got half of the vote. And the difference is that Iowa is drawn by a nonpartisan commission, which is what I believe you and Melissa Sargent and then Tim Cullen and Dale Schultz are pushing for here. As we said, in Wisconsin, 190,000 more people voted for Democrats than Republicans. They control the Senate, they control the Assembly, and they got 5 out of the 8 congressional seats. It almost renders me speechless that anybody would not support changing this. And what I don't understand is that it's not inconceivable. People move, okay? And over this 10-year period, it's not inconceivable that the Democrats could take things back by 2020 and be in control, in which point they could do the exact same thing, locking themselves in for a decade. So why wouldn't the Republicans want to adjust that?
What I've talked to the people privately, their biggest concern is that if Democrats were in control, that we would just repeal the redistricting and then redistrict the way we wanted. So I'm not sure, Peter, if you have any suggestions
How did they find out that was the plan?
Yeah, exactly. And like, no, I said, part of the thing is we're going to be here for a while. I plan on running for a long time. And I'm going to be sure, and a lot of us, it's really important that everyone knows the freshman class of the Assembly, the Democrats, we all stood together, all 14 of us, pushing this bill, which is exactly like the Iowa model. And we're going to be here for a long time, and we're going to be holding our colleagues accountable. And we're not going to go against it in 2018 or 2019. Right. It's ridiculous.
Well, I hope I'm still around to congratulate you when you get it done. But it needs to be done, obviously. It just undercuts democracy to such a ridiculous extreme that the Democrats who actually won the majority of votes for state legislature have literally no power in the state legislature.
Well, you know, I mean, Peter,
there's something wrong with this picture, folks.
You and I had covered this on an episode several months ago, and I made the statement that the Republicans didn't legitimately win. And you corrected me, and you said, well, technically, they did draw the districts, but they won those districts. So technically, they legitimately won. And I think the argument can be made that Madison is going to be very blue, and it's got a large population. So you could say, well, yeah, there might be more Democrats voting, but the way, you know, that doesn't mean that they win statewide. But isn't that the entire point of this, is that these districts should be drawn in a way, according to what the Isthmus is saying, where you cannot look at the voting records, the voting history of that district, and you've got to... It's got to be drawn. I think full counties have to be in, and the congressional seats have to include three Senate seats, if that's right. Whereas in the way that they did it, they chopped up, I think, 11 Senate seats amongst the, are cut in half to put into these congressional districts. Many counties are chopped up. Milwaukee County, they admit you can't just say this county has to be in because of the amount of people there. But when Voss was talking, he said that the way they did it, it goes almost down to the voter. That's how close they looked to draw these as fair as possible. I say that in quotes. As fair as possible to Republicans, they might have looked down that close. I don't have any doubt of that. The Isthmus is talking about how to protect Paul Ryan, they sliced up the Blue Rock County and pulled in part of Waukesha County. I mean, it doesn't... If anything, it gives me... I can take solace in the fact that they know that they are so unpopular that they have to start resorting to this. I mean, that's what this says to me. And maybe you could say that in Illinois, too, that the Democrats don't have the hold that they look like they have down there, and they have to chop it up. I don't know. I'm not from Illinois. But what have you heard anything from voters? Have you heard any citizens say that they are opposed to changing this? Or are voters pretty much united that this needs to be reformed?
Oh, the voters, the people in the district that I represent, the 79th Assembly District, are 100% on board that this has to be changed. The gerrymandering has to stop. They have made that loud and clear.
But having said that, and I don't question at all your analysis there, let me ask a different question. What percentage of your total voting electorate would you say actually has what would you describe as at least a moderate level of consciousness about the issue as an issue? To start with,
I would say probably 75%.
That's very high. That's very high. And that may well be true in your district. And you should get credit, I think, for helping to educate your district. If that's the case, clearly that's part of why it is the case. Because my thought is that on a statewide basis, it would be very unusual to have even as many as 50% of voters tuned into that issue.
I think one of the interesting things about the district that I represent is they split up the Windsor-DeForest district into three. So I have three wards in Windsor. Keith Ripp has some of Windsor, and Representative John Jagler has DeForest. So when I was going and knocking on doors during my primary and meeting all these people, they said, why do we have three people? Why is it that why did they do this to us? What did we do wrong? No offense, Diane, but what did we do wrong where we have three different people and my kid's going to go to fourth grade and we're going to be like, yeah, who did you meet? We have no idea because there are three different representatives that represent one school district.
Do you know what they do? Don't mean to be facetious, but one of the answers could have been, and I don't know how many times you would have gotten a yes or a no, but what went wrong could be responded to by, did you vote in 2010?
Yeah.
Did they do the same kind of thing in Waukesha, which is an extremely red county? Or is that something that they did? I don't know how much you can say being a representative, but did they do that because we're Democrats? Or if you go to Waukesha, do you see the same thing?
No, they did that because they wanted to put that piece of, DeForest in Dane County. They wanted to put that with Representative Jagler's district. Because I think that's where Representative Keith Ripp had a hard time in 2008, maybe it was, when this woman, Trisha, ran against him. So they divided up Dane County as best as they could.
It is about 25 past the hour. You're listening to Civil Discourse on Janesville Community Radio. You can find us here every Saturday at 11. Go to blogtalkradio.com, do a search for Janesville Community Radio, and click on Civil Discourse. Let's look, Representative Hesselbein, at this from a slightly different angle, because in the article that you wrote in the Cap Times about this, you brought up something that I think is really important, and people might be looking at this from the perspective that we have been, but you and Melissa Sargent said that some of the laws that have been passed and the way that these Republicans have to vote in order to avoid a primary is due to the way these districts are drawn. And the rejection of Badger Care is the example that you used. That's going to cost us, what did you say? It's going to cost 83,000 Wisconsinites health care.
Right.
10,000 jobs and $86 million.
We're spending more money to cover less people because we rejected the federal money. More money, less people. That doesn't make any sense.
Fiscally conservative.
As far as fiscally conservative, that does not make sense.
Would you attribute it to just personal animus by Governor Walker towards the president?
That might be part of it, but then he says yes to other federal money. I can't get a read on what is good federal money for him and what's not.
Well, yeah.
Have broadband, he said goodbye to the train. But then other federal dollars he seems to think are okay, like the propane, help us with that. I don't know. I'm not sure what makes the good and the bad list anymore.
I did an analysis of the amount of... I think the train was expected to bring in somewhere around 14,000 jobs, another 10,000 from taking the Badger Care money, not to mention what the train would do to the economy as a whole, where people in Madison who can't find a job now have the option to go to Milwaukee, vice versa, and be there in, what was it, 45 minutes or whatever. It was just some ridiculously quick amount of time that you could make that commute. And, yeah, it would have taken 10 years to build the thing or whatever they said, in $800 million. What I found interesting that I don't know if I've mentioned on this show is that that train was expected to cost $1 million a year, I think, to keep it running. Walker's tax cut for the wealthy, when he went and he, you know, did Act 10 basically and then gave a lot of the money away, the, you know, wealthy, that tax cut would have funded that train for over 100 years. And yet he said that we couldn't afford to do the train. And now you've got this governor who promises 250,000 jobs, and yet every time that we've got a real option here to make jobs, to create jobs, he turns it down. And we're going to get into his proposed tax cut here soon, but this is just political grandstanding, and he's – go ahead, Peter.
Don't forget about the Pinocchio Range up north. He's not against creating a few jobs for out-of-state you know, men in black with machine guns to keep the environmentalists away.
Yeah, that mine.
And possibly a couple hundred jobs actually mining.
Well, see, that's the thing, is that even the, you know, the most friendly estimates for that mine, I think, say like 700 jobs. Yet here's 10,000 just sitting there, just sitting there. Mm-hmm. And yet, I mean,
well, apparently the train, whoever would be operating the train, wouldn't have any sense of financial loyalty to the Republican Party. But I think that, the opposite, the converse, would be true of the mining companies that propose to tear up the Pinocchio Range.
I completely...
I'm just saying, that could possibly be in the background somewhere.
And as a representative, you know, you're dealing with the people who are voting on this. Do you get any sense that had these districts not been gerrymandered, that people might be voting a different way?
Absolutely.
You do.
I think they'd be listening to the people in their district, and they would realize they have to work with us. And right now, Peter pointed out earlier, sometimes they don't. I mean, they don't need our opinions on things, so they go forward on their agenda. You know, people keep asking me, especially right now, what's happening at the Capitol. I don't know. I mean, it just seems to be that the speaker, Robin Voss, is talking to Fitzgerald. There seems to be a lot of angry people and a lot of lobbyists. I haven't seen this many lobbyists since the budget. And they're there all the time, and they don't come to see me.
I was just going to ask
you. Because they don't need my vote on something. But I've been working with you know, Republican colleagues on different things, and it's hard to even get a meeting with them because everyone's going to see them right now.
In the 2014 race, you know, we'll see what happens with Mary Burke. I think that, that's it's just way too early to really look at where we're at with her right now. But the Assembly, I am pretty confident in saying, is out of reach based on what we just talked about. What's your feeling about the Senate? Is there any chance of flipping the Senate?
Well, first of all, I would say, are we going to get the majority in the Assembly? No. But we are going to pick up seats. We have candidates that are working all over the state of Wisconsin, and there are some still, I think, that Howard Markeline seat, right? And he's, of course, running for Senate. That is a Democrat performing seat. And Robin Voss was talking to somebody the other day. It was tweeted out that that's one of the ones they're going to try to protect as far as Republican territory. But Dick Cates is there. He is doing a fantastic job. He has been fundraising. He has been knocking on doors, talking to voters. I really believe Dick Cates will be the winner in that one. And there are some other races, too, around the state of Wisconsin that I think the Assembly will pick up. Will the Senate flip? I think it will.
Do you really?
I really do.
Where do you see the main opportunities?
Now, these districts in the Senate have not been voted on yet, correct? They drew the maps in 2010. Half of them went in 2012. So these voters
new
have
to some people.
Yes.
Right.
Okay.
For some people, it'll be a brand new area. I think we're going to be definitely picking up that Dale Schultz seat.
Mm-hmm.
He's doing a great. I can't think of his name. He's doing a great job. I think Howard Markeline is too extreme for that district.
He's extreme, yeah. But he's very rich.
What about Mike Ellis? I'm hearing that he's vulnerable up there.
He is very vulnerable up there. My colleague, Representative Penny Bernard-Shaper, is doing a fantastic job up there as well. And he hasn't had a race in how many years, Peter?
He didn't have a race when I served. He was already a veteran when I served with him, and that was 30-some years ago.
Exactly. So I think this is all kind of coming back at him going, wow, I've got to go out and work for this now.
Maybe enough is enough, and you really wonder if he can. It just gets harder as one gets older to put out that kind of energy for a truly competitive campaign. And he hasn't had a truly competitive campaign for a long, long time. So is he going to be able to get out there? Will the wig stay on? I don't know.
And you wonder if his enthusiasm is there. I mean, I think it must be very hard if you're a Republican and you vote for Act 10 and you vote for the mine and you vote for all these things. If they're just voting to get along and you don't really believe in these things, how hard is it going to be to campaign and talk to voters about why you took the votes you did if they don't truly believe in them? And I don't know Mike Ellis that well. I'm not sure if he was all for Act 10 or not. I have a feeling he
was
not
originally. Originally, he was not. He actually, we covered this one. When Walker sat him and Fitzgerald down, Ellis was completely opposed to it. He said, this is not going to get through the Senate. And Walker pretty much said, you're going to get it through the Senate.
Ellis was thinking of the way things used to work.
Right. And that's what I mean. Is he going to be all that gung-ho to be a part of a party that's done this when he's had to eat all those votes?
And he's been there a long time. What about? It's not like some people like to hang on, but he certainly has served a lot of years, and he's given some presumably good service for his district, some not so good. But whatever it is, he's been there for ages, like 40 years plus, and maybe it's just time. So that's encouraging. What about Cullen's seat? Now, you mentioned a moment ago Cullen and Schultz working on something, and I lament the fact that the people who are giving the leadership on such an important issue are short-timers.
Leaving.
They're gone.
Both leaving.
Okay,
yep.
So forget about that, or leadership from them on that issue. But Cullen's seat, is it pretty solid? Is that
Absolutely. Okay. That's completely. Once again, they redistricted it, so they know they're probably not even going to have a Republican run there.
Oh, really? Has anyone on the Democratic side declared?
Janice Ringhan. She's running representatives on the Beloit area, I think.
Oh, okay.
So she's got a base. She's a sitting state rep.
Which
yeah,
then
she's
brings up.
She's got the base.
Yeah, she's
which
got the base.
Then brings up the question, what about her assembly seat?
I think they found somebody for that one now.
What about Fred Clark's seat now that he's not coming back?
I am so
and you're
sad.
Friends with Fred Clark.
I am
why
friends
is,
with him. I'm so
why
sad.
Is,
that's the one I'm really bummed out about.
Why is he not coming back?
He wants other opportunities. He never wanted to do this for his entire career, and it is so difficult being in the minority. He's been a real good voice for the environment, but that mine, I just think that took a lot out of him because it was just fighting and just saying, how do you educate those who won't listen? It's very difficult. And I don't blame him. I wish him the best. He's got some great ideas for a business he's going to start up. He'll be fantastic at it. He's a forestry guy. He and Representative Jeff Marceau get along really well, and they do a lot of bipartisan stuff together. They even had something about global warming in the assembly this year, just a hearing. And poor Republican Jeff Marceau took a lot of heat from his party because they don't believe global warming exists. And it was just really unfortunate because they just really wanted to bring other assembly people in there and talk about it and just start the conversation. So Fred Clark has done a great job for the state of Wisconsin.
I agree. And on the on the climate change thing, just one quick snippet that is really discouraging from a progressive standpoint is that our governor, a lot of people know about the who's the little tax guy out in Washington, what's his name? The guy you got to sign the. You know who I'm talking about. I can't get any words out.
I'm sorry. I'm not following which.
The guy who makes you sign the thing that you'll never raise taxes.
Oh.
That group.
Americans for.
Norquist. Grover Norquist.
Grover Norquist. The Koch brothers have a similar petition that you have to sign contract that says you will never pass any kind of climate change reform. And I bet you'll be surprised to hear that Scott Walker's name appears on that contract. So what's sad is
I'm not surprised.
What's sad is that even if Fred Clark was able to get somewhere with that bill, it would just be dropped right there. It would never be signed into law.
That's unfortunate.
I think it's really important. And I say, and I don't mean to be presumptuous about it. Obviously, there's a primary yet to be held, but let's be candid. Mary Burke's the candidate. She's got the money. She's got the support at the national level. And then to have the national folks get involved in Wisconsin is something we did not get to any significant degree during the recall. And that was contributed, in my opinion, to the result that we ended up with. Whereas the National Democrats now see a chance. If Walker wins this election, he is actually going to run for president of the United States. The thought is breathtaking. If he loses, he's no more of a serious candidate than Rick Santorum was, and probably not even that serious. So, I mean, it's over. And presidential ambitions are down the drain if he loses the governorship. I also notice that there's so little interest in the attorney general's race. There should be a lot more, but there just isn't. And if you look at how much money that three announced candidates have raised combined compared to, let's say, Mary Burke and Scott Walker at the gubernatorial level, it's like a penny to the dollar or something like that. And there's so my prediction is that if whichever person wins the governorship is going to bring in the attorney general candidate, because people don't pay that much attention to who's running for attorney general. And chances are, if Mary Burke has enough momentum to win the governorship, she'll bring along the attorney general candidate.
But that's not always the case. Think about Jim Doyle. And yep. Jim Doyle, Kathleen Falk was our candidate, and that's when JB got in.
We do have
exceptions.
That was a surprise. I remember being so shocked that night that people voted for Jim Doyle and then JB. And they just went around the other. I mean,
The Lautenschlager incident, though?
There was a primary between Kathleen and Peg Lautenschlager, yes.
Okay. That may have hurt. Yeah, and Peg I won't say anymore.
But I will say, I don't know if I'm going to be on here again or when I'll get the opportunity, but I think Mary Burke is a great candidate. And I think she is doing a great job. And I'm really excited to work with her. And I was talking with Jim Doyle at that Obama event that we had last week. And he was laughing. He's like, you have no idea how many times I just had to veto something. He's like, that was one of the biggest gifts I had, veto.
Exactly.
Like, think of all those bills that you have to talk about on the assembly floor. And you talk and you talk and you talk and they pass them anyway. Right. Doesn't mean they're going to get anywhere.
And if we can pick up some seats, as you're predicting, in the assembly, and maybe take over the Senate or at least not lose ground in the Senate, then there's no way to override her veto, assuming Mary Burke would win. There's
absolutely
no way to override her vetoes. That's a huge, huge, huge point.
That would be fantastic.
You know, this, you know, Peter, you and I have talked about this before, and I take so much heat from Madison progressives when I make this statement. And I'm interested to hear what you have to say, Representative Hesselbein, because I realize that it's kind of a jaded statement, but I think it's realistic, because I hear so many people on the far left who are not happy with Mary Burke, and they really wanted to see Kathleen Vinehout. And my opinion is that Mary Burke is a good candidate, and number two, she's going to be a heck of a lot better than Scott Walker. With that said, as we've discussed, even if we pick up seats in the assembly, it's not going to flip. Most likely, the chances of that flipping are extremely slim. So even if Bobby Kennedy came back from the dead and got into our governor's mansion, you're not going to see real progressive bills getting voted on and passed. You can stop the leak with Mary Burke, but to be completely pessimistic and tossing her under the bus, I think, is just counterintuitive, is not helping at all, because she's the candidate that we've got. She's going to do better than Walker, and at the very least, it's going to stop a lot of these things from going through. That's my take on it.
I think a lot of people on the left, progress, I mean, I consider myself center-left, but people who are maybe more to the left than I are not entirely happy with a businesswoman who has generated the old-fashioned way considerable wealth. But it's a purism that is self-defeating and has historically been. And I remember going back, and I've done this to you before, to our listeners, but I just have to mention it because it sticks so strongly in my mind, even as young as I was at the time, when Nixon beat Humphrey. Of course, there were so many progressives who said, you know, Humphrey beat McCarthy in the nomination, and there was a bloody convention in Chicago. Of course, Bobby Kennedy had been assassinated along the way. And a lot of Democrats just couldn't bring themselves to get out and support Humphrey. And Richard Nixon appointed five members of the Supreme Court. Five.
Elections have consequences.
Five. People forget about stuff like this. I mean, it's nice to be purist. We need our purists. But when it comes around to the general election, we need a general election candidate who can defeat Scott Walker. And if we had someone who was considered far left, let's say, that would significantly reduce our chances of actually winning the general. Whereas having someone who's viewed as more of a moderate, maybe slightly left of center, but also with an understanding of business. So Scott Walker can't say, oh, just another left-wing Democratic politician. She's a business person and a successful one.
She is the kind of person that he is constantly preaching about as a job creator, and you can't raise taxes.
He's scared of her and should be.
And he should be with his dismal job record. He should be worried about her. The other thing I wanted to say is, you know, I do have friends that are disappointed that Kathleen Vinehan isn't running, but that was Kathleen Vinehan's decision.
Right.
And now it's time to say, okay, I hope she heals from that car accident. I hope she does great things for the state of Wisconsin. But now we need to move forward and band together as progressives, as Democrats, and get Mary Burke in there because she's going to do fantastic things.
Thank you. That is what we needed to hear. I am in complete agreement with you. And you know what you were talking about, Peter, to kind of put this in perspective about Richard Nixon and the appointees to the Supreme Court. Scott Walker won't be appointing any Supreme Court appointees unless he wins this election and runs for president and has enough money to actually get him into the White House. You will see him taking his failed agenda nationwide. And are you really willing to take that risk because you're not happy that Mary Burke is not exactly 100% of what you want? That's my question.
People can be short-sighted.
One thing I'm always curious about, though, with Mary Burke, and like you said, she's done a great job in her business, and some people hold the fact that she is wealthy against her, but I don't remember those conversations about Herb Kohl.
Yeah.
And I wonder,
yeah.
I sincerely wonder if there's some sexism going on from the far left, and I'm sure I'll get some angry calls this week, people saying that, well, how dare you say that on that radio show?
Well, I'm glad you're saying it.
Thank you.
I'm glad too.
Because I've had it. I've had enough. And the Democratic Party is for women, and let's not forget that. And what better message to send is having our first Democratic woman be the governor of the state of Wisconsin. This is something exciting we can all agree on. It's time.
Thank you. Yes.
That's exactly right, and you're so right in pointing out that no one mentioned that about Herb Kohl that I can remember.
No.
And he was, I mean, his net economic value, I always hate the term, that person is worth so much, because to me, everybody's
I agree with you. Worth. That's hard to say.
Measuring people by wealth. But in terms of his economic worth, it was in something like $600 million, well in advance, ahead of Mary Burke.
Absolutely.
And
nobody made a peep about it. Nobody said, oh, that Herb Kohl.
Nobody made a peep.
No. Herb Kohl used that to his advantage. I'm nobody's senator but yours. And he funded himself.
Yep.
Absolutely. And don't you think Mary Burke's going to be nobody's governor but ours? She's not going to be bought out by Washington or mining companies or anything else. She's going to be serving the citizens and the residents of the state of Wisconsin, period.
I agree with you. And here's, you know, she took heat last week. From actually, I think, some more of the centrist people when she didn't go see President Obama. Now, she had already had campaign stops lined up. She said that she spoke to the president on the phone the day beforehand. Do you think, okay, I guess this is kind of a twofold question. Number one, do you think that's going to help, hurt, or be indifferent? And number two, do you think that Barack Obama is becoming something that Democrats are trying to distance themselves from?
I don't think they're distancing themselves from him. I think it was one of those situations where she's darned if she does and she's darned if she doesn't, because if she met with them and she dropped her engagements, whoever she was meeting with would be very upset and hurt and go to the airwaves and say she can't even keep her promise now. How do we know she's going to keep her promise in the future? So she did I thought she did the right thing. She kept her promise to the people she was meeting.
That's a fantastic way to look at it.
She can also be strategic. Keep in mind, the president is likely to be here at least one more time before the November election.
I hope
several more times.
I hope I get closer.
Right?
I hope so.
And well, you don't need to get too much closer from what you described.
Maybe
anyway.
I'll get to shake.
It is quarter to the hour. You're listening to Civil Discourse on Janesville Community Radio every Saturday live at 11. Go to blogtalkradio.com, search for Janesville Community Radio, click on Civil Discourse. We are having a conversation with State Representative Diane Hesselbein. We're talking about Scott Walker and Mary Burke, which goes right into the final topic that I want to make sure that we hit on, is that Mary Burke supported the proposed increase in the minimum wage that the legislature in Wisconsin voted on that would have gone up to $7.60 an hour and sadly did not pass. She has now embraced the 10-10 minimum wage as proposed by the federal government. Scott Walker was asked if he would raise the minimum wage, and he said flat out no. And then he called her out and said that she is political grandstanding for trying to raise the minimum wage. I ran a few numbers here, and this Scott Walker is running around the state right now talking about this tax cut for the average homeowner of $150 a year plus something else, still comes out to less than $200 a year. Raising the minimum wage on a full-time person who is making only $7.25 an hour right now, working 40 hours a week, 52 weeks a year, raising that minimum wage to $10.10 an hour is going to bring in almost $6,000 a year for them.
Almost all of which will be spent on consumer items, which will have an effect of growing the economy.
Exactly. Absolutely. And every when you're at that level of the economic scale, which is sadly at the bottom, these people spend all of that money, and $1 generates about $1.60 in revenue back for the government and economic, you know, for the economy. And Scott Walker says that this is political grandstanding.
Scott Walker's position is understandable. It's contemptible, in my view, but it's understandable because he knows he's crass, and he knows perfectly well that the majority, vast majority of people who would benefit from a minimum wage increase, if they vote, will vote Democrat. So why would he be out fighting for them and fighting for more votes to come out for Mary Burke? So, or Democrats in general.
Isn't that sad?
It is, to say the least. But it's the reality. And if you look nationally, I'm convinced that there are two issues that have the potential for giving the Democrats back the gavel in the U.S. House of Representatives, holding on to the Senate, and then that trickle down, so to speak, to the states that we could see benefits in Wisconsin elections and other states as well. And that one is minimum wage, and the other is the abortion issue, because the states that, because of the 2010 debacle, went totally red, have passed all kinds of unconstitutional, under Roe v. Wade, unconstitutional laws restricting abortion rights, women's health choices, closing clinics. I think that if the president is clearly addressing the minimum wage issue right now and using the bully pulpit to push that issue hard, it's hard to get a lot of people. I mean, I'm sure as you prepared for your first race, I'm sure you had counsel about primary voters versus people who tend to vote only in generals and not in primaries and so on like that. Okay. One of the keys, like when I first ran, for example, if I had followed the conventional wisdom that you only go to the primary voters, I could never have won. So I had to go to the people who vote but don't usually vote in primaries, only generals, in order to get a 50% larger turnout than usual for that non-gubernatorial primary year and defeat the speaker. We're in that kind of position now in an off-year election where there's no Obama at the head of the ticket or presidential candidate at the head of the ticket. You get less voters. Happens every time. Okay? Every time. The question is, by what degree? And what can bring, with Obama not being at the head of the ticket, to motivate some people to stand in line for 10 hours where necessary, and so on? What can drive people to take the initiative, to take that amount of time necessary and go do it? To me, minimum wage is certainly one of those issues. Minimum wage is, there are so many people who would be affected by the if we look at the demographics of who votes in midterms versus the voting population in general, you have a much higher percentage of minimum wage workers or close to minimum wage workers who vote in general in the presidential elections than vote in the midterms. But if they know they're going to vote for $3 an hour raise for themselves, I mean, if that message can be made salient,
give America a raise.
You don't get out and vote, shame on you. And totally different issue, but same principle, freedom of choice for women. I mean, what is being done by Republicans nationally on this is just heinous, and not to mention unlawful. And if women don't, I mean, if the message isn't put out there so that women understand what's happening and what choices are being taken away from them on almost a daily basis in a number of states, that I would think would be a motivator to get people out in 14 who might not normally be midterm election voters, but rather just normally presidential year voters. Does that make sense to you?
It absolutely does. That's a great, great point.
Thanks. Rachel Maddow did a story on this about how the president is out pushing for this 10-10 minimum wage, and the fact that the Republicans on the federal level are not allowing this to go through, and they won't even pass unemployment insurance through the Senate now, let alone through the House of Representatives. There's no, but they want people to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, but they refuse to, you know, do the things needed to make that happen. But what Rachel Maddow pointed out was that this is the Democrats figured out a way to push people to the polls, exactly how you just said. They're getting out there, and because it's not happening on the federal level, people can push Mary Burke and go out there and vote and campaign for Mary Burke to get it done on the state level if they have to.
Absolutely.
They can do that in the Senate elections. They can do it in the House elections. And this could not only save the Senate, pick up some governor, you know, some governor's mansions around the country too. I'm not in the camp that the House of Representatives is going to flip. I know some people still hold on to that. I just don't see that happening. But I don't discount that we could pick up some seats with this strategy.
You don't need that many seats. I mean, it's not, well,
I think 17.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think we have some vulnerables in the state of Wisconsin, though. We've got some good candidates running against some of that.
I agree.
Kelly Weston running against Sean Duffy.
Yep.
After he blew it, especially during the sequester, and was interviewed over and over again saying the worst things, totally off message, I think she's got a really good chance.
And he's the one who says that he can't live off his $174,000 salary, yet he also doesn't support unemployment insurance. He doesn't support raising the minimum wage.
It just so happens my law practice takes me up to Wausau quite a bit for reasons I won't explain now, but it just happens. And so I do spend a lot of time up there, and I agree with you that my read of the local political scenario is that it's a that race is wide open.
Absolutely. I think there's a really good chance there.
So let's see here, back on the tax cut thing. Walker has also snuck in, and maybe you know more about this, snuck into this $504 million tax cut issue that he's pushing right now. Let me read this. 92.1 put this out on their website. Not many taxpayers in Wisconsin are familiar with the alternative minimum tax since it affects so few state residents, generally those with six-figure incomes. Tucked into Scott Walker's $504 million basket of tax cuts are significant changes to the state's alternative minimum tax that could deliver some $50 million in savings to roughly 30,000 filers by 2016. 30,000 by 2016. Today, there's only about 7,000 people benefiting from that. $50 million. And it's all going right to the wealthy. Again, yet he doesn't support raising the minimum wage, and he doesn't support unemployment insurance.
None of that surprises me.
And he comes out, and he talked before the president went out, knowing that the president in the State of the Union was going to push for a minimum wage. Scott Walker, I think, to maybe ABC or CBS, something, a local station. He said that raising the minimum wage is just political grandstanding. But if the president were to support retraining workers, well, I'd be the first one standing there to clap right in front of him. Here's my question.
Well, the president does support that. Let's see if he can walk the walk.
That's exactly right. Is the president did push that. And I haven't heard Walker come out and, you know, praise him for it. But on the other hand, my question for anyone who supports Walker in this position is, this guy is out here saying that he supports retraining workers because workers lack the skills to do the jobs that need to be done, yet he takes money out of schools. The places where people can get those skills, can learn things, so that we don't have to do that later on and just be so reactive when we can be proactive.
Well, absolutely. They've taken more money out of public education two budgets ago than has ever been in the history. And one of the things we saw in Milwaukee, we had the Life Skills Academy. They had 66 kids there. There was one kid, one child, one student only, who was proficient in one subject only. And the kids went to go to school the next day, and the place was closed. Where were the people that owned Life Skills Academy? This private school that's unaccountable, that's using our tax dollars. Everybody that's listening has to know that they're your tax dollars for Life Skills Academy for 66 students. One kid was proficient in one subject only. And the people that own it upped and moved in the middle of the night. The kids went to school. Where are the teachers? The place is closed. I have no idea what's going on. They're now living in Florida. The owners are living in Florida in another gated community, starting up an unaccountable voucher school system in the state of Florida. That's what's happening with our public school dollars. That's what we're doing. We're not giving it to our public schools. We're giving it to unaccountable private school vouchers.
That's follow the money.
It's about as fiscally responsible as turning down the Medicaid money, which is the money that we already paid in. When 100% of that is funded by the federal government, we're just getting our own tax dollars back. And he says no.
It goes beyond. This is one of the things I like about being a former legislator, Diane, is that I can say whatever is on my mind now because it doesn't matter anymore. I'm not running anymore. Not that I didn't say what I thought before, but you have to be a little more guarded sometimes. It's to me, it's not just financially imprudent. We're talking about an immoral, depraved set of priorities.
I agree. Absolutely agree.
So do I. And, well, it's going to be interesting to see what happens in this, you know, gubernatorial race, because Scott Walker is extremely flawed, and we've only scratched the surface here. And this, to be honest, this show wasn't meant to just sit here and attack Scott Walker. But
it's so hard not to, though.
It is, because you can't talk Wisconsin policy without talking about these failures. I mean, we just found out that we've dropped to 37th in the nation for economic growth and 49th according to another survey, and it's just, the income is down across the state. There's just been nothing really for Scott Walker, for, in my opinion, to claim as success.
Let me make a proposition you can research, and we can talk about it next time. Scott, let's see if Scott Walker's top 100 political donors have had suffered any economic decline since he's been governor.
And my guess is that John Menard is doing just fine.
That'd be my guess, too.
That actually takes us right up to the end of the program
here. Can I say one thing before?
Absolutely.
I just want to tell everybody, be sure you go out and vote April 1st. Wherever you live in the state of Wisconsin, there are elections going on for county board, mayors, villages, town people. Get out there and vote. Every single election is important, and if you want to move your state forward, and perhaps you're unhappy with the leadership there right now, you could always do stuff on the local level. So vote April 1st.
Did the county board put the marijuana referendum on the
legalizing marijuana is on the referendum, and so is fair and nonpartisan redistricting for the state of Wisconsin is on the April 1st referendum.
Very nice. Make sure that you get out there and vote. We want to be sure to thank Janesville Community Radio for giving us the platform to do this program. A shout out to all of our friends at 350 Madison who are fighting for climate change reform. They held a vigil. I believe they had 150 people show up on Monday night against the Keystone XL pipeline. So congratulations to you guys. Thank you to the Oconomowoc Dems for your support, the Rock County Democratic Party. Be sure to check us out on iTunes. Give us a 5-star rating and make sure to leave a comment. Check us out on Facebook. Go to Civil Discourse and like our page, and follow us on Twitter @CDiscourse. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, just give us an email at civildiscourse2011@hotmail.com. We're here every Saturday at 11 on Blog Talk Radio. Search for Janesville Community Radio. Click on Civil Discourse. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you, Representative Diane Hesselbein.
Thanks for having me. It was great also meeting you, Peter. Glad we had this time together.
Same here.
Thanks to everyone. So-